Okay, then I guess we can start. Yeah, okay.
So, I mean, probably the last problem is, for example, there's this question of two-wind hangman and distillation.
Right.
Right. When you do a little algorithm on each side, then you discard some, and you don't discard some. Mm-hmm. So we proved that. So for the pairs you keep, the probability of errors is smaller. Well,
if it's
smaller than one half, obviously.
Right, that's right. If the initial error rate is small.
Yeah. But at the end, right, you discard quite a bunch of pairs.
Yes.
So when you say, okay, I got, you know, it's not much less efficient. So you have a.
Yes, absolutely.
So does that play at some point in the. I don't know, in arguments that this is better than not doing anything?
Well, yeah, so, I mean, so what you can do, I guess I didn't draw any of these pictures last time, but what you can do is you can say, well, so like for the one-way capacity or the two-way capacity, your goal is to say what's the most number of pairs I can get, or the most fraction of good pairs I can get out at the end, given this error rate, right? And so if you plot that, you know, it, so for one way, it might look something like this. So here's one, let's see, so this is rate here, k over n. So it's the fraction of good pairs you end up with. And then here's the error rate. So this here is maybe, you know, the 0.19 or so of what you can, so as lower error rates, you can get a much better rate because, for instance, if you use a random stabilizer code, you need fewer generators.
Would that be convex?
Yes, this is convex. It depends what you consider convex and concave.
Okay.
Exponential?
So I think, if I'm not mistaken, this is the correct version of convex for this. The point is that if you take a point here and interpolate, you get, so this is the allowed region, right, the region that you can achieve. And so if you interpolate between two points, you're always still within the allowed region. So the allowed region is convex. Okay. Right, which means that it's concave down, I guess, as it curve. So this would be the one-way capacity. Well, we don't know what the upper bound is, but this is what the lower bound looks a little bit like this, you know, with some teeny little thing that's too small to see down here. And then if you go up to, you know, a half here, then if you look at the two-way capacity, well, if you do the protocol I said, you're going to get a rate that would look, well, I mean, it's so that, so strictly speaking, if you use the protocol that I said, you'd get a rate zero in the asymptotic limit as n goes to infinity, because you're supposed to get arbitrarily good accuracy when n goes to infinity, right? And to get arbitrarily good accuracy, you need arbitrarily many rounds of this iteration, which means the epsilon is zero. So the best thing to do is not to do that, but to do a couple of rounds of that until you get within this region that's allowed by one way. Or I mean, that's not the best thing to do, because it might be that once you get away from one half, you have better two-way protocols also. But we don't really know. I mean, so there's, I mean, this people have looked at some things, so you can do slightly better than this. But basically, one simple way to draw a curve would be to say, well, okay, we'll start here, and we'll do a couple of rounds. So if we're somewhere in here to start with, we'll do a couple of rounds until we're here, and then we'll do the one way to get the rest of the way. And so then the rate will look like, I don't know, I'm not sure what the actual thing for it. It's going to look something like this, and it's eventually going to hit this curve. Okay. And then obviously there's something much smarter you can do rather than doing more rounds of this iteration. But the point is that this stays non-zero all the way out to a half. At least that was the point of the problem. Yeah?
Is it really talking about? I guess it has to be if you're going to do that.
Uh, Not sure. I mean, I would think it's a tau, some kind of exponential, right? Because, but it's, since it's discrete kind of point-wise thing, it actually may, no, that's not right. I was going to say it's going to be, it might even be stepwise linear, because the question is how many rounds you have to do, right? That's going to make a big difference. But each, so there's going to be, there are going to be kinks in it. Every time you have to do an extra round, you get another bend. But the problem is the pieces are not linear themselves because the probability of acceptance changes within every term. Yeah. But this is also not the true curve, right? Because we can probably do better. Anything else? Okay. So then let's move on to the new material. The topic of today's lecture and probably some of next week's is going to be topological quantum error correction. So we're going to start out with a kind of simple topological quantum error correction code. And it's going to be just a regular stabilizer code. It's one that you could do using all the techniques that we've talked about before. But it has this interpretation, as you'll very quickly see, in terms of topology. And that's going to be a lead-in for kind of another approach to fault-tolerant quantum computation, which I'll probably at least start on today, but not finish until next time. So what is this original code? Well, the toric code. Well, really, it's a family of codes. And so what we're going to do is we're going to take a torus, right, a donut, and we're going to put a lattice on it. And we're going to associate qubits with edges of this lattice. Okay, so so you can draw a torus a conventional way like this, but it's much more convenient for the purposes of describing the code to draw as a square. Let me make it bigger. Okay, and well, it's supposed to be square, approximate square. The actual dimensions don't matter. This is a topological thing. But the so how is this the same thing as this? Well, what we do is we identify the top and the bottom, so that if you go up the top, you come back in the bottom. And if you go up the right, you come back in the left. So we're identifying the left and right, the top and bottom. So it's like one of those old video games where you go up one side, and you come the other. And that gives us a torus, right? Because if you take a piece of paper like this, and you identify the top and the bottom, well, you get a cylinder. And, well, it's not going to work so well with this paper because it doesn't stretch. But you can easily see that if you take a tube, right, and you twist it around, you'll get a donut. Okay? So this is a torus. And so we're going to put a lattice on this. So, and then we're going to, the qubits, okay, so remember, the left and the right are identified here. So there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 columns here of lines. And the seventh one is just the same as this first one here. And we're going to put a qubit on each egg here. And again, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And then the seventh is the top again. So we have a 6 by 6 arrangement. So this is going to be square root of n here.
And you meant to make it 6, right? Did you mean to make it 6?
No, that doesn't matter. This is just an example. So this is why I'm writing square root of n on the side. So the point is there's going to be a total of n qubits, where n is some square. Could be any square. Well, let's say greater than 1. Not sure if 1 makes sense here, but I'm not even sure 2 by 2 makes sense. So let's say at least 3 by 3. So we have n qubits, and they're located on the edges here. Okay, so like this. Sorry. I won't draw them all, you get the idea. Okay? And so then we're going to define a stabilizer code. With the following generators.
Okay.
Yeah.
Doesn't that 2n qubits?
Oh, it might be. Yeah, you're right. 2n qubits. Right, because there's n here, there's n rows, so there's n kind of horizontal ones and another n vertical ones. So we're going to define a stabilizer code. And there's going to be a generator of each stabilizer associated with each vertex, and another generator of the stabilizer associated with each square. Okay? So, the ones with the vertex are going to be star operators. And they're going to they're going to be z z z z on the edges adjacent to that vertex. On edges including the vertex. So, for instance, we have z z. Z, Z here, right, for this vertex, and for all the others too. And then we also have generators associated with the plaquettes, as I said, and maybe you can guess what those are. These are the plaquette operators. And they're x, 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 x on the edges bordering the square. Right, so for instance, we have x, 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 x here. Okay? Everyone see that? So what do we have to check? Well, we have to check the commute. So let's think about that. Well, if you have something like this, where so the z's all commute with each other, of course, and the x's all commute. So we're going to have to check that the stars and the plaquettes commute. So if they're far away from each other, they don't overlap at all, then clearly they commute. So what's the interesting case? Well, the interesting case is when we look at, say, a star, here's this vertex, and a plaquette, where that vertex is one of the corners of this square. Right? That's the only case where they share qubits. And well, what happens then? Well, you get ZZ and XX. So they overlap in 2 qubits, and therefore they commute. Okay? Yeah?
Is there any particular reason to use a square lattice as opposed to?
No. So, in fact, I guess I was going to mention this later, but since you asked. In fact, you can take the torus and cover it with basically any graph and define the same thing. With each vertex, you do ZZ on all the edges around that vertex, which could be any number in principle. And then you have to define each region, replacing the squares. They can be funny shapes now. And do XXXX on all the edges surrounding that region. And that still works, because you still have the same phenomenon that if you have a region, well, modulo some really weird shapes that go, you know, all the way around or something. That if you have a region and a vertex on it, that vertex just it only involves two of the edges. Okay. Which means it'll commute still.
But does that have any advantages?
It has some advantages. It's just easier to talk about this one. It has advantages in the case of the torus, not particularly big ones. But any other questions? Okay, so so let's see. So what are the questions we'd like to ask about a code? One of them is, there's two usual questions, right? One of them is how many qubits it encodes. One of them is what its distance is. So let's start with number of qubits. That should be relatively easy. So let's think. So we have 2n qubits, and we have, how many vertices do we have? We have n of those, right? Because there's, again, n intersections in each row and n rows. Sorry, square root of n intersections in each row and square root of n rows. So there's n of those. And then there's n Plaquette operators by the same argument. So we have 2n generated and stabilized. So you think we won't have any encoded qubits at all. But it turns out that's not right, because these things are not all independent. Okay, so let's think about that. So in fact, I claim that the product of all the star operators is the identity. So let's think about that. What happens when we take the product of all the star operators? So let's start. Okay, let's do the middle first. It's easier to think about. So we do here, and we take z, 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 and then we multiply by this one. We get z, 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 z again, right? But we got two z's on this egg, so they cancel out. And then when we do down here, z, 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 we got also get two z's on this egg. And you see that every egg is bordered by two vertices, right? So every egg will get two z's, and they'll all cancel out through the whole thing. So we'll get identity overall. And similarly, the product of all the Plaquettes is the identity too, by the same argument. Because if you take the product of all the Plaquettes, well, each egg, it borders two squares, right? So the x's will cancel out. So that means that we don't have 2n generators to stabilize. We have 2n minus 2. And since we have 2n qubits, that means we have 2 encoded qubits. Right? So let's see. So so now, in order to think about the distance, it's actually going to be helpful to think about what else is in the stabilizer. So what happens if we take the product of, well, let's think about the quartets. It's maybe a little easier. What happens if we take the product of a couple of quartets? What do those operators look like? So let's look at it in some subset here, right? So we have two squares next to each other. And we have x, 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 x here, and x, 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 x here. Okay? So if we take the product, what we get is, well, we have the two squares. We only have the x's here cancel out, and we just get x's around the outside. Right? And similarly, if we take a product of three of them, we're going to get, like, say, three like this. We just get the outside here. Okay? So in general, if we take products of the Plaquette operators, what we get is a union of closed loops. Okay? And not just any closed loops. This is going to be an important point in a moment. But closed contractible loops. So these things, so the unions are called cycles. Is that right? Sorry. Cycle is just a union of loops. A union of contractible loops is called an exact cycle. So the reason I say contractible is because, well, the torus, there's loops that are not contractible. Right. If you, if you have your donut, and for instance you go all the way around like this, there's no way you can shrink that loop to get to just a point, because you know there's a hole in the middle of the way. And similarly, there's a loop that goes around the other way. So in our picture, our square, that those are the loops that go around this way, and so that start here, for instance, go to here and then come back. Or the ones that go up like this and then come back. And then there's more complicated versions of those, like ones that go around multiple times or that do one way and the other way, things like that. Okay? But we don't get those in the stabilizer, as it turns out. Right? Because we just take the product of these things, well, the loop that we get is always going to be the boundary of the set of plaquettes that we used. Yeah?
What if we can't, if we go all the way up one column and use every plaquette, don't we get two non-contractible loops? Or does that not matter?
We get, yes, okay. So that's still considered an exact cycle, and it's still contractible, but it's contractible in a funny way. why don't I go on, and it'll be maybe obvious in a second how it's contractible. The reason it's contractible, so it, yeah. Yeah, okay, well, okay, so it'll be a while until I can maybe explain very well why it's contractible. But the idea here is that since these are loops of x's, right, pairs of x's will cancel each other. So two non-contractible loops, you can put them together, and they become contractible. So the actual definition is not that it's contractible, it's of an exact cycle. The actual definition is that it's the border of a region, which in this case is maybe more clearly true. So I can remember it like that. Okay, so the real non-contractible loops we'll consider in a moment. For the time being, let's think about what happens with a non-loop. Okay, so if we just have some set of x's in general on qubits, well, we could draw those as a series of lines, or maybe they form a tree, or there's a part of a loop and something else, right? I mean, it might look something like this if you draw out something like that, if you draw out its positions on this graph, this lattice, right? So these are, each line represents the location of an x. Remember that we have these star operators too, right? So for instance, we have a star operator here, right, which is trying to draw z, 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 z. Okay, and you'll see that this thing that I drew anti-commutes with that, because it has one x on these four things. Right? And in fact, it's going to anti-commute also here, because there's three in here and here and here. So things that are not a union of closed loops are necessarily going to anti-commute with some star, right? Because they'll have some endpoint. Okay? Everyone see that? Okay, so these.
What if it's just two x's? It's just the line?
Just two of them.
Two x's. Right, then it's going to commute with one of the ones.
Then it's going to commute with the one in the middle, but the ones on the ends will both anti-commute with it. On the other hand, if you take the x's that go all the way around, well, that's something interesting. That's the next point. But these non-cycles, we've argued, are outside N of S. Okay? So if we have a set of errors that doesn't form a closed cycle, we can detect it. And on the other hand, if you have a set of errors, set of bit flip errors anyway, that's all we're thinking about for the moment. Have a set of bit flip errors that form one of these exact cycles, we don't have to detect it, it's in the stabilizer. Right? It's the identity. Okay? So that leaves the non-exact cycles. These non-trivial loops. Okay, so let's think about those. Well, so the if you take a loop that goes all the way around like this. Well, it's certainly going to commute with everything, right? Because each of these star operators has two qubits that are on this loop, right? And the ones down here have zero. So these are in N of S, but you can't get them by taking the product of any stabilizer generators. So they're outside S, and these are undetectable errors. Okay. So what is the the smallest one, right? That's something we're going to need to know. We're not quite ready to say what the distance of this code is. We have to do this for the z arrows also, and I guess the y's. But we just added these x non-exact cycles. What is the smallest one that that satisfies these properties? What is the smallest non-exact cycle that has?
Root event.
Root event, right? Because, well, it just goes straight, right? Obviously, there's longer ones where you go like this and then maybe come back down, something like that. But this, the shortest one is just the size of the choice. Okay.
Then you can
continue. Oh, yeah, right. Okay. Okay, so what about the z operators? Well, so the so the way to do that is to consider what's called a dual lattice. Or at least this is one easy way. So the dual lattice has a vertex in the middle of each region, so the middle of each square. And then the edges connect vertices for adjacent squares. So if we have when I said you could use another lattice, it doesn't even really matter that it's square. I mean, it could be, you know, 5 by 10. But as we'll see in a minute, that means that it's going to correct different numbers of bit flip bit phasor. No, actually, it doesn't mean that. But yeah, it means there's one short way to go around the torus and one long way, which is OK. Just maybe a little inefficient. OK, so what does a dual lattice look like? Well, we put vertices here. And edges here. And then we also have to go around, remember? Okay? So if you see, I mean, it's still on the torus. And it's still a square lattice. And it's basically just the same thing. So in fact, if you do that, the Hadamard transform, transversal Hadamard, switches the standard toric code with the toric code on the dual lattice. Okay, and so what that tells us, and of course when it does that, it switches the x's and z's, right? So the z errors we have to worry about are the non-contractible loops in the dual lattice. So and the stabilizer generators or the elements, I should say. Are the exact cycles on the dual lattice. These are called co-cycles. And the undetectable ZRs are non-exact focycles. Okay? So it's these yellow things that go around. Which means that if you were to draw them in the white, this kind of the qubits are ranked the wrong way. Maybe easier to say over here. So you're taking a cycle like this. Okay. Okay. Okay, so what does that tell us? That tells us that, again, the shortest z errors are also going to be square root of n. And so the distance of this thing actually is square root of n. Right? The y errors, you can break them down to an x part and a z part. The length of each of those has to be at least square root of n. So what are the parameters of the code? We have 2n qubits, 2 encoded qubits, and distance of square root of n. Okay. So this terminology of cycles and cocycles comes from some more advanced math. If you happen to know it, what's going on here is that the code words are associated. Well, so the code words. So remember that the undetectable errors correspond to the logical x bar z bar operators, right? And so the undetectable errors actually correspond to the code words in some reasonable sense where the data is encoded. And so these code words are associated with the non-trivial loops. But if you go around twice, then it's okay, right? Then that's back in the stabilizer, right? Because that's something that's a border of a region. So what that means is that this is these things are associated with what's called the Z2 homology. Of the torques. Or I guess more precisely the graph that we've placed the torques. Okay. So if you know what that is, great. If you don't know what it is, it doesn't matter. At least it doesn't matter for this class, really. Okay? Any questions? Yeah?
When you do this on graphs, do you forbid, like, loops?
So you mean just an arbitrary graph? So you mean self-edges? I don't think that's required. You have to be a little careful how you define edges then. But it's certainly simpler if you avoid that. Anything else? Okay, so like I said, this is just a regular stabilizer code in some sense. Certainly, you know, while we've motivated by drawing this torus and thinking about topological effects like non-contractible loops, you know, in some sense, it doesn't matter. We can just think of it as a stabilizer code and treat it as such. And doing that, well, it's maybe worthwhile thinking about the fault tolerance for this code, because actually it has some nice properties. So in particular, the nice property that's really exciting for fault tolerance is that all the generated stabilizer have weight 4, right? Which means that, say, if you want to do short error correction, you don't need very big cat states to do that. And in fact, because they're all kind of local, it turns out you can kind of skip doing the cat states at all. And, well, then one error might cause multiple errors. There'll be errors that are close together, so only a couple of qubits. Maybe that will be a little more obvious in a little bit. But I want to say a couple of words for how you do the fault tolerant operations in these codes. So first of all, it's a CSS code. So therefore, you have a CNOT operation available, which is automatically transversal CNOT. There's two encoded qubits here, right? So what this is doing is going to do a logical control knot between those two encoded qubits with the two encoded qubits in another block. Hadamard, I kind of mentioned already. So what happens if we do the Hadamard? It turns out that if you think more carefully about the X bar and Z bar operations, there's two encoded qubits, right? So X bar for the first qubit, let's take that to be the loop going vertically. There's multiple loops going vertically, of course, but they're all equivalent up to elements of the stabilizer. And therefore, the Z bar on the first encoded qubit should anti-commute with that, which means that we only want it to intersect in one point, basically. So we want it actually to be the loop that's going around the other way. Okay, so what that means is that when we take the Hadamard, and then the x going the other way, and the horizontal x and the vertical z are going to be the things for the second qubit, colors for the second qubit. So that means that when we take the Hadamard, we're actually, first of all, we're going to the dual lattice. But it means that the things going horizontally, So before we had x, vertical x being first qubit and horizontal x being second qubit. But now it's vertical z for the first qubit and horizontal z for the second qubit, which is the other way around from what we had before. So in other words, for the Hadamard, what we have to do is we have to do the transversal Hadamard and then flip diagonally. Right, so for instance, if you take the torus and go flip it across this diagonal here. That does the encoded Hadamard on both the encoded qubits. Okay, and then you have to maybe do some realignment to, I'm not even sure if that's necessary. Okay? So this is relabeling all the qubits. So this is not exactly a transversal operation. So what we're doing is we're doing the transversal thing, and then we're rearranging the qubits. So that uses swap gates, remember, which is a little dangerous, but we discussed how to do that. Yeah? Well, that's the other thing you can do. But then you have to be careful, of course, because when you do then, you know, say another C-naught with another block, you might get which qubit is which mixed up. Right, because if one of them has been flipped and the other one hasn't, then it'll be backwards. Okay? But most of the time, that's probably good enough, so long as you are careful and keep track. So what else do we need? We need a bunch of other gates. Let's say we need a pi over 8 gate. So I don't know how to do that using some kind of relatively nice thing. But we can use the techniques we developed before, right? So if you can create an ancilla state for the pi over 8 gate, that's, you know, this Bell state, for instance, then you can use teleportation and so on. So how do we create that ancilla? So I'm not going to go through the grungy details here. But the short version is, well, what you can do is you can non-fault tolerantly make it for a very small torus. And then we can grow this torus by adding rows and columns of qubits. Okay, so I'm not really going to explain how to do that. But basically, if you add a row and column of qubits, you measure the generators, then you have some information that you can use to figure out what's going on. Okay, so you do this, you grow it, and you have now you have an ancilla that's encoded in a bigger torus. But unfortunately, it was originally made with a small torus, so the error rate is lousy. So what we have to do then is we have to take these ancillas and distill them against each other, right? So I showed you one of these protocols using. I guess for the pi over 8 ancilla, I showed you for the 15 using the 15 qubit code. So we distill these ancillas to improve their reliability. And if you were working with a really, really big torus to start with, well, then. Maybe we have to, you know, do this in a couple of steps. So we have to start with a small one, grow it, distill, and then grow it some more, distill again, and so on. Okay, to get more and more reliable. Right? We're never going to be able to distill to greater reliability than the current size of the torus. Because, you know, if we happen to have a fluctuation that causes one of these bad errors, then the state's going to go wrong. So that's why we might have to stop if we want to get really, if you have a really big torus, we want to have it be really reliable. Right? So we'd have to stop at intermediate stages to get closer and closer to that point. And of course, the process of growing it is going to introduce errors too. We have to do error correction along the way, stuff like that. Okay? Yeah?
Is there an easy way to do the gauge between the two qubits in the same torus?
Well, there might be. There's some not so easy ways. So one of those not so easy ways is to create an ancilla block where the encoded state is an EPR pair between those two qubits. Okay, and that lets you start to do stuff by. Doing teleportation, so you can teleport the qubit in the second qubit in one block to the first qubit in a different block, and then you can interact stuff like that. So there are such tricks that work in general. In fact, with general stabilizer codes, there might be some shortcuts for the Tor code. I'm not offhand sure. I have to think about that. There probably are. I mean. I'm not sure if they're any easier, but there are topological things you can do to a torus that will kind of distort it in various ways and mix up what these different cycles are. So if you do one of those, maybe. I don't know. Okay, so anyway, the upshot is that if you do this, you can actually get a threshold result. And it's a threshold result that doesn't use concatenation. All it does is use arbitrarily large torus. Torque codes. So that might surprise you. I mean, after all, the distance of these things is only square root of n. But if you think about it, well, square root of n is only kind of the worst case, right? If you have a set of errors that exactly line up and go around a circle, a non-contractible loop, then that's a problem. But if you just kind of place errors at random, if you think about it, are not very likely to do that. Well, at least if you only have a small fraction of errors. Okay, so but we should think more about exactly what happens and how you do the error correction. But before I do that, are there questions on this fault-tolerant stuff? Yeah?
At least
so I'm not sure what the number is when you take into account all this gate stuff. But if you just want to store data using the Torah code, the threshold is about 10 to the minus 4, or at least that's a lower bound. And furthermore, well, okay, so this doesn't actually use the Torah code, but a variant. Furthermore, you can do that in two dimensions with just nearest neighbor gates, and still have this 10 to the minus 4 for storage. Other questions? Okay. So what does it look like if you have these errors? So okay. Come on, keep colors in chalk here. Maybe three just in case. Okay. So what happens? What happens if we have an X error? Okay, let's use that third column. So we have an X error on this qubit. Well, that shows up in the stabilizer as two star generators, two star operators that have the wrong eigenvalue, the eigenvalue minus 1 instead of plus 1. So those are these two, right? So we can think of these as like a pair of defects. Right? We have all these local things, local conditions that are supposed to be true. These four are supposed to have even parity, and these four are supposed to have even parity, and these four are supposed to have even parity. These four are supposed to have even parity too, but they don't. They have odd parity. And similarly, here we have a defect. Okay? So we have like these two particles that are next to each other, these two defects. And if you have another X error right next to it, well, what happens then? Well, this is no longer a defect, right? That stabilizer generator is now satisfied. But we do have a defect here. Okay? And so in general, if we have some set of X errors, and we draw them as this collection of lines, well, at the end of these lines are going to be the defects. Okay, and those are the things we actually observe. Right? Because this is the synchron, basically, the locations of these defects. Or at least this is the one half of the synchron, right? There's also the other part for the other kinds of errors. And so the other kinds, of course, are going to have defects in the plaquettes. Maybe let's fill them in to distinguish them. Okay, so we have these two types of defects. And they always come in pairs. And in order to correct the errors, we'd like to line up the pairs, right, to say which ones came from... Well, not only where do they, which ones are connected, but what's the correct path between them? Okay? So for instance, if we take these four defects, we could align them like this, and then we'd be right. And if we did that correctly, we'd get back to the original state. But suppose we did something else. Okay? Suppose instead of this thing, actually, we need a fourth color. Is there a fourth color? So suppose we try to connect these two, okay, and then we have to pair up these two. So we did something, I don't know, like this. Okay, so obviously we're not doing the right thing, but is it going to cause a logical error? You're shaking your head no. Why? It's a closed loop, right? So the product of the actual error and the thing we did is a closed loop, and it's not just a closed loop, it's a contractible loop in this case. So it's in the stabilizer.
Well, could you also sort of argue that, well, basically any path you take between two defects, you call it, basically, you know, you're going to correct for errors, but they're going to cancel each other through that.
Well.
Right, like, for example, if you correct for
Yeah, I mean, so this is kind of the point. So this is, since this product is in the stabilizer, this means that the one we did is equivalent to the true one. So in general, it's going to be true that the correct pairing and our choice of pairing together form a cycle. Okay? But it's not always true that that's always harmless. Right? So let's give an example where it's not. Well, so in this case, we have these two right next to each other, so it's kind of obvious the way to connect them. So we connect them like this. But what happens if they were actually created like this, with a series of Z errors that went around, most of the way around? Okay? Now, when we take this cycle, it's a non-trivial cycle. And it's not, so this product of the correct thing and the thing we did is not in the stabilizer. It's now in n of s minus s. So that's a logical error. Okay, so maybe now you can understand why the big torus has a threshold, ignoring the fault tolerance stuff, but say just it'll tolerate a constant error rate. That's because when there's a very small rate of errors, the defects are very small, they're very localized, and these things tend to pair up very close together, right? But when you have lots more errors, it becomes much harder to see how to connect things together. And you'll make mistakes. And at some point, there's a critical value where there's kind of a phase transition. It's a percolation phase transition. And now you don't know how to connect them up anymore. And you're very likely, if you guess, to connect up something that goes all the way around. Okay? Point is, as the error rate gets higher and higher, the kind of the clusters of these loops get larger and larger. And eventually they get so large they might go all the way around.
Well, can you sort of impose a condition to never close things together using a non-exact loop?
Well, see, the problem is that you only know, you don't know what the actual error was. Right? So the loop is composed of two components. One is the things that you're doing, and one is the things that the errors are doing. And you don't know what the errors are doing. So it's hard to coordinate with them to make sure it doesn't.
Sure. What I'm saying is, you can impose, let's say, your algorithm of finding where the, or deducing where the error happened. You just impose of never deducing that something happened in a non-exact loop. So would that sort of lower?
But look at this example, right? So you assigned it with just a single place, right? But you were wrong. It's actually there were three errors, not just one error. So the point is that the thing that you're doing, well, certainly that should never look like a loop that goes all the way around. That would be kind of silly, because that's always going to be longer than something that doesn't go around. But the problem is that, particularly when you get more complicated things where you have lots and lots of defects, it's hard really to see. Take the example where you have defects that kind of range themselves like this, right? So there's two ways of pairing these up. One of them is this way, and then up here. And the other is this way. And if you guess right, then you've corrected them. If you guess wrong, then you've gone all the way around. So there's no way you can distinguish those two, really. Okay. Other questions? Okay. So so that's the basic for code. So as I mentioned before, you don't have to stick with the standard line. So there are actually a couple of variants of the TOR code. So you can use other graphs. So first of all, you can use other graphs in the torus. But you don't have to stick with the torus. You can use other surfaces too. So for instance, if you have a genus G surface, so G is kind of number of poles. So you can imagine a donut with a number of poles. It, you have you take a donut and you add like a handle to it. And then you could add another handle, another handle, and another handle. And those are all actually the two manifolds, the two surfaces. And so genus G is the number of handles, with the torus being genus 1. And so it turns out, again, if you put a graph on this thing and do the same construction, you get a stabilizer code. And again, the qubits are associated with non-contractible loops. And they're, in this case, 2G non-contractible loops. Kind of independent non-contractible loops. Yeah?
Do you still get the sphere dependence for distance?
For constant G, that's probably scaling like that, but there's some G in there also. And it depends on exactly what lattice you use to cover it. Right? Basically, in this case, I think it's impossible to avoid having some loops that are longer than others. So it's just kind of a matter of how you can best optimize that. But I think for constant G, it's probably still going to be order squared, I think, but I'm not positive of that.
So the square root of n here is because we picked the height and the width to be equal in this particular line.
Well, yes, but really the reason it's appearing is because it's a two-dimensional thing. Okay, so these higher genus surfaces, you can draw. So for instance, you could draw an octagon and match up the side somehow. And you see basically the dimensions are still going to be roughly square root of n, right? I mean, the limit where you get many very high genus, it's going to be a circle, and you'll have the area being pi r squared, right? And r, 2r is the length to the round. The hammer, in fact.
That's sort of the smart choice, that's what I mean, is because if I could have picked, if I had picked the width to be different from the height, then it's a different
question. Oh, yeah. So absolutely, absolutely. It's still in this family. I mean, this is kind of the standard for a code due to square lattice, for exactly this reason. But you don't have to, that's right. Right. Okay. And so this is maybe a more interesting thing to do. Well, this is pretty interesting. And of course, these other surfaces, you could take a weird graph on these other surfaces. You can actually even take a non-orientable surface. So, well, you probably know what amoeba strip is. Amoeba strip has boundaries, so I haven't gotten to that quite yet. But there's something like amoeba strip called the projective plane, where it has, so the torus has an inside and outside, basically. The projective plane doesn't. It's hard to imagine. You can't embed it in three space. Yeah. It's related. So the projective plane may be the surface of the Klein bottle. Or no, maybe Klein bottle is a projective plane with a handle. Anyway, they're related. So you can even do stuff on that and get some interesting codes. But another thing that's maybe more useful to do is, well, since this does involve only local stabilizer generators, it would be kind of convenient if you could do it on a plane rather than having to do it on a donut, right? Because then you could actually just take some planar thing and apply local checks to force things to meet its code. And so that's been done too. So you can make planar codes. By setting boundary conditions. So depending on exactly how you define so now you take an actual square, not just a square with edges identified. And you have to do something different for the stabilizer generators on the boundary. Basically, there's two things you can do. One of them is you can leave it flat like this and still treat this as a graph. The other is you could add edges sticking out. And so you have to do that right. Basically, you have alternating edges that do one and the other. And I think what happens when you do that is basically you lose one qubit. So for instance, if you just do it straightforwardly, you have one encoded qubit. You can have more complicated things where you have a hole in the middle, and then you get another encoded qubit, and so on. Okay, and I know I didn't explain that, but the point is that they're out there. Okay, and so once you do that, then really you can talk about the threshold result in a strictly two-dimensional, well, maybe you need three dimensions to have the multiple encoded qubits that are interacting with each other. But if you just want to store things, you could do that just on a flat surface using just local gates and still get a threshold of, like I said, around 10 to the minus 4. OK? Right. So another variant, which I'm going to talk about in a moment, is the toric code using qdits instead of qubits, dimension d things. But I'll get back to that. So before I do that,
get your comments in shock.
Oh, thanks. And probably this is even more important. So before I do that, I want to talk about thinking of this toric code in a kind of more physics-y way. So again, we're going to take advantage of the fact that these stabilizer generators are local things. I mean, we haven't really taken advantage of that except for my hand-waving regarding this threshold. So in fact, what we can do is we can define this code space as the ground state of a local Hamiltonian. So what is that local Hamiltonian? Well, we're going to sum over over generators and stabilizers. So that means over vertices and over squares. Something that looks like this, 1 minus MA. Where the MAs are the generators. And probably for completeness, I could include not just the 2n minus 2 independent generators, but all of the 2n generators that I originally defined, just to keep it symmetric. Or maybe the more interesting case is when I go to this planar code anyway. And I forget what the numbers are there, whether you have to exclude things there or not. OK? But the point is that each of these generators is only interacting 4 qubits that are all next to each other. Okay, so 4 qubits is kind of a lot already for a local Hamiltonian, but it's not totally crazy. Okay, so you might imagine it being some kind of effective theory, which you have some stronger interaction that gets integrated out. Okay? And now let's think about, so this Hamiltonian, the ground state, well, the ground state is degenerate. And that's just because the ground state is the code space here, which, remember, is encoded 2 qubits, so it's 4 dimensional. But let's think about the excited states. Well, these stabilizer generators all commute with each other, so we can diagonalize this. And so the excited states just correspond to the synchrons of the stabilizer. Which we've already said we can describe as this kind of gas of defects. Okay. And in the continuum limit, we get kind of a particle model, right? Where the code space becomes a vacuum. So there's no particles. And the defects are particles, and they can move around by having additional errors. Which, going back up here, you see they can do without any extra energy, right? So remember, we had these two things here. If you had another error here, well, this defect moves over here, right? But doing that, it doesn't change the total number of defects, and the energy of this Hamiltonian is the number of stabilizer generators, local checks, that are not satisfied. So if you have just one particle move from one point to an adjacent point, that doesn't change the energy. Yeah.
They can also annihilate.
So obviously in a closed system, there's some kind of problem where the energy goes. But assuming that it's connected to some bath, thermal bath, then when they annihilate, the system relaxes to a lower energy state, basically. Sometimes, of course, you'll have this thermal bath and it'll go the other way, and it'll excite a pair of defects. They have to come in pairs, right? Because a single error will produce a pair. Okay, and then that pair will diffuse around, and maybe eventually they'll annihilate with each other or with some other ones. So if it happens that they go all the way around before annihilating, then they change the logical encoded state. If not, if they just do a contractible loop, then the ground state of the king. Okay? So let's think about this diffusing around some more. So in particular, let's suppose it's not diffusion, but we're kind of doing it on purpose. We have some big Tor code. And we have two defects. Now, if we just take only x defects, for instance, we can move them past each other and nothing interesting at all happens. And if we just see defects, they commute with each other, so we can move them around kind of independently. But if we have both an x defects and z defects, then something slightly interesting happens. Not very interesting, but slightly interesting. And it's a window to something much more interesting. So let's use these colors in a different way. So here we have, I'll use the old convention. So here we have one kind of defect, and here we have another kind of defect. Okay, and suppose we do a whole series of local errors that move this defect around in a big circle like this, until it comes back to where it started. OK? Well, what happens? Well, how do we do this, first of all? So I forget which I did. So this is, so we move this around using z errors. OK? So we do z, 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 et cetera. OK? So what we've done is we've done a product of z's around this closed loop. And actually, it could be the kind of the co-cycle version of this. These are z's. So what does that mean? Well, suppose we'd done it differently, actually. That's a good question. What if we had instead gone down here? Right, so we'd done z, 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 z down here. Well, how would that differ? Would that be a different result? Well, no, because the difference is by we're doing this instead of this. So it's the product of these two loops is basically this times this inverse, or the product of one loop with the inverse of the other one, right? Which is, again, an element of the stabilizer. This is a contractible loop. OK? So. So in particular, we can deform these loops. And of course, that's true when it's not a loop also. I mean, if you just go from point A to point B, you could wiggle the path in some other way and get basically the same effect. So in particular, let's imagine deforming it until we go in this loop. And then back here. Okay? Well, so these two things will cancel out. Right? And because we do z's here and then z's back here. And so this thing around here, if we shrink it as much as possible, it's a stabilizer generator that surrounds this defect. Right? It's z, 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 z around here. And what do we know about that? That has eigenvalue minus 1, right? That's what the defect means. So there is one thing that matters. And that's how many of these other kinds of defects we go around. So if one of these z defects circles an x defect, then we get a phase of minus 1. Of course, if it circles two x defects, well, we get two phases of minus 1.
For zero phases of minus 1. For zero phases of minus
1? If that's, I mean, that's the same as...
I understand, but I mean, so they're equivalent, but it could be this or it could be the other.
Well, no, really. I mean, so the loop, so if you think of a loop that goes... that goes like this, it's really, I mean, you can contract it maybe to two small loops like this, but you can't get rid of it altogether. Whereas a loop like this can be totally shrunk to nothing.
Okay, I was thinking about, yeah. I was thinking that the eigenvalues of the stars that are minus 1 are basically the ones in between. So these are not cut by the loop. So that's what I was thinking.
Not sure what you mean. That means, so maybe this will be more obvious when we go to the next example, the higher dimensional toric code. Higher dimensional, I mean, two days. And in that case, there is not this factor of two that's important. Because two here is qubits, x squared is the identity. That's what's relevant here. But then we'll get phases of omega. And then you'll see you have to go to the to d things. Or, well, they'll have separate charges. So. Okay, but does everyone see this example? And we have these particles, effectively. And we can move them around, but if you move one around each other, there's a global phase of minus 1. This is a global phase. Like I said, it's not that interesting. But later today, we'll start to at least imagine what's going to happen if you get things that are really more interesting than the global phase. Okay, let me start to define, let me at least define this higher dimensional torque, this two-dit torque code. And start to talk about its properties after the break.
Just a quick question before you start going two-dits.
Yeah.
Can you go from surfaces to volumes, topological volumes?
You can get you some stuff. So it becomes much more tricky. There definitely are things you can do in higher dimensions. The four-dimensional toric code is pretty interesting, actually. So one thing you can get is a better ratio of distance to, wait, is that right? Well, you can get, yeah, so what you can get, so the distance doesn't improve. Distance gets worse in some sense, because you have more ways to go around. But you don't have to do generalization of torus. So what you can get is you can get a reasonable distance while, as you go to larger and larger dimensions, while getting more and more encoded qubits. So that's one thing you can get. And there's some other properties too, but you don't have quite the same nice duality. I mean, depending on exactly what you're doing, I mean, there's a lot of different choices you can make. You don't really have the same nice duality between the x and the z. So in the four-dimensional toric code, there is a duality, but then now things are not on edges, they're on, I guess, squares and three-dimensional spaces, and it's a pain in the neck. At least it's hard to visualize. Okay, so two days. So It's going to be almost the same. So first, I guess I have to add the word cuted here. So that's one difference. And we have 2n cudits. Well, OK, let's not be silly. OK, so the main thing we're going to have to do is, well, it's not, so if you think about it, zzzz and xxxx is not going to cut it anymore, right? Because zz and xx don't commute anymore. Right, when you use the mod d version. So let's. So we'll use big D as a dimension here. So what we're going to do is we're going to assign an orientation to each edge. Okay, so we can, for instance, make these edges point to the left. It's too big at once. And these edges, I don't know, will point down. Okay, and then for the stars, well, it's going to be kind of similar, except that, what's the convention I used? So we use z when the edge points towards the vertex. So in, and use z inverse when the edge points out. Okay, so for instance here, this is pointing in, so we use z. This is pointing in, we use z. This one's going out, so we have z inverse, and this one's going out, so we also have z inverse.
And pointing in what?
So for this particular vertex, pointing in is towards that vertex. Okay. And then for the plaquettes, and of course, if we then go to the adjacent one, what's in for this vertex is out for this one. Right? Which is good, actually. Well, okay, it'll be more obvious when we do the plaquettes. So for the plaquettes, so we use. So now, we don't have in and out, we have clockwise and counterclockwise. So we use x when it's the edge is clockwise. And x inverse when it's counterclockwise. Okay. So in this case, that's counterclockwise, so we have x inverse, this is clockwise, so it's x, and this is x inverse. Yeah?
Okay, maybe I'm missing something, but when you consider it's just the next vertex, then whatever point in, or the next vertex is going to point out.
So that's right.
I have a z and a z minus 1 conflicting.
Right. No, they're not conflicting, because they're separate generators, right? So we have one generator.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
That's z, z, z inverse, z inverse. And here we have z, z, z inverse, and z inverse of this one.
Yeah, my bad. Maybe I'm just.
Okay. So actually, let's consider that. So what happens when we have, say, two plaquettes in a row, and we now want to take the product of those two? Draw them really good. Okay. So So, I should say that this doesn't depend really on the choice of orientations. That can be arbitrary. Although, well, yeah. So it's nice to choose something systematic so you don't get totally confused. But, so down here we have x inverse, x inverse, xx. Now here we have x inverse, x, x inverse, x. Great. And when we take the product of these two, what do we get? We get x inverse up here, x inverse on the left. These cancel, x and x inverse, because one of them is clockwise and one of them is counterclockwise. And then on the edge here, x inverse, x, x, x. Right? So these part is clockwise and this part is counterclockwise. Okay? So again, as before, if we take the product of these generators, we get the same rule on a loop that's the border of those parquets. And similarly, we have the co-cycles here. Okay? Of course, the stabilizer contains more complicated things, like it contains this square, right, which is not the identity anymore. So if you wanted to treat that correctly, you have to weight the loops by the amount that they appear. That's more complicated. We don't really need that. Okay? And so because of this phenomena that you get the same kind of loops going around, this thing also has distance square root of n. And all the same basic properties hold. Except now, there's one phenomenon. So let's go back to your question. What about two loops going around? The thing is now loops have orientation, remember? So what's the boundary of a script that goes here? Well, orientation, say, is into the script. So it should be a loop that goes down this way and then up this way. And that's reflected here, kind of. If you think about stretching this to all the way around, so you have x's on one side, x inverses on the other. And that's what the boundary of the region is. Of course, if you chose the orientations differently, it wouldn't necessarily look that way. But it would be, one side would be with orientation, basically one against. Okay? And because it's d-dimensional, you could, instead of having mod 2 homology, you have mod d homology. So you can have loops that wrap around d times. Well, up to d times. So d minus 1 times is still non-trivial. That's the same as looping around backwards once. Okay? Okay. So we will take a break and then come back and talk about the defects moving around in this code.
Who came up with this stuff?
Yeah, keep that. I've been cut off.
So the,